All right, Gabriel Rockhill, thank you so much for coming on to Reimagining Soviet Georgia.
Thank you so much for having me on.
So why don't you introduce yourself? Who are you and what do you do?
So I am a philosopher, writer, and activist. I mainly focus on the kind of history of the modern world and contemporary struggles around imperialism and cultural imperialism. I've been engaged for decades in kind of working both in and out of the traditions of European critical theory, which I've found to be extremely limiting. And so my most recent scholarship digs much deeper into the historical materialist tradition and also marshals tools from that tradition in order to understand more concretely and coherently the traditions of thought that I was trained in, which are the more the European tradition of Frankfurt School critical theory and French theory and things like this. So this is at least a kind of opening way of presenting, you know, some of the things that I'm interested in, but I'm sure we'll get into more of them as the conversation unfolds.
Great. I read your article, the CIA and the Frankfurt School's anti-communism. And I thought it was really interesting because the Frankfurt School and Western Marxism are, you know, known to be Marxists, but then you make this claim that they are afflicted by anti-communism. So if you could just sort of outline, you know, what is this anti-communist element of mainstream critical theory or Western Marxism that you investigate in this essay and other writing that you do?
Well, what's remarkable about the history of Western Marxism, and that I didn't know when I went through my own training in higher education, is that it's largely a product of a series of material forces that I now understand are the forces of cultural imperialism, meaning that there's been a vested interest on the part of the imperialist ruling class, as well as their political state managers and the professional managerial intelligentsia, to transform the deep history of Marxism as a scientific weapon of class struggle from below into a palatable form of Marxism that works seamlessly with what the Central Intelligence Agency called the compatible left. And the compatible left is a left that isn't a threat to capitalism or to imperialism, but will line up at the end of the day regarding the most fundamental line of struggle, and that is whether or not there is an alternative to capitalism, or if the alternative is much worse than capitalism itself. And so Frankfurt School style critical theory, which, you know, emerged in the interwar period and really became prominent after World War II and was very much promoted within the dominant channels of the Western intelligentsia, is a form of Marxism that is not only skeptical of actually existing socialism, but openly hostile to the endeavors on the part of those in the Soviet Union, in China, in Vietnam, in Korea, in Cuba, you could go on down the list, to govern themselves. And it is therefore rife with what Lenin referred to with others as social chauvinism, meaning the paternalistic belief that the, you know, best forms of thought and the most philosophically advanced members of Homo sapiens needed to be in the kind of cutting edge of world development and world civilization, meaning in Europe, and that it couldn't possibly be the slaves in the colonies who were developing anything like a socialism worthy of the name. And so this is one of the fundamental divisions, I think, between what people call Western Marxism, or some people call it cultural Marxism on the one hand, and then Eastern Marxism or revolutionary socialism on the other, meaning the former tradition, which is the Frankfurt School is part of, is not invested in developing socialism in the concrete world. Instead, it's invested in criticizing socialism in the actual world even more vociferously and with a greater kind of rabid form of critique than they call into question capitalism. And that is then opposed to a long and deep tradition, you know, stretching from Lenin to Mao to Ho Chi Minh to Che Guevara to Thomas Sankara and many others, that recognize that the real power of Marxism is not to create discursive pyrotechnics and complicated word games and impress people with knowledge and sophistication. It's to actually help the working masses. And to do that, you need a theory that is engaged in practice and constantly learning from practice. And so a lot of the Western or cultural Marxist tradition has turned its back on praxis very explicitly and very openly, and argued instead for a kind of authentic Marxism or true Marxism that wouldn't be sullied by what all of these Bolshevized barbarians in the periphery are doing, and that is transforming the pristine corpus of Marx into something that actually matters for working people, because it has lifted millions and millions of people out of slavery, super exploitation, and oppression. And so that dividing line, I think, is really important for people to understand if they don't understand it already, because at least in my own education, I was always trained that there's one Marxism, and that Marxism is this cultural Western Marxism that is opposed to actually existing socialism.
So this cultural Marxism that we hear a lot from the right wing constantly being attacking, and so-called left, I'm hearing the left being described as the Democrat Party, and I'm so confused. Like, lately I've just been like, who are they talking about? This constant, Elon Musk's rant against the left, of them controlling Twitter apparently, and this left being equated to some kind of, Democratic Party / wokeism, is one of the strangest phenomena. Like, I could see now that all the signs were pointing to this, but like still so flabbergasted, and being the people that are actually oppressing the left being labeled as the left, so confusing to me, and just disheartening as well. Maybe you can speak about this new phenomena that they've somehow made the bad people, that the real people, regular people now hate, is the left, which is not the left, but they have, absorbed our names and, co-opted it. Maybe you can discuss that too. It was just for sort of a modern day US and the West.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I think you're right. Insofar as you see this, both within mainstream media, but then also within the intelligentsia, at least within the capitalist core, the idea that the left is actually this pro-capitalist, pro-imperialist left, and that the difference ultimately between the right and the left comes down to some cultural issues. Those on the so-called left are woke, they engage in identity politics, they want further forms of representation for certain minorities, but they don't want structural change. They don't want redistribution in any serious sense, they don't want class analysis, and they certainly don't want to break with imperialism, as we've seen with all of the so-called progressive members of the Democratic Party lining up and doubling down on the US proxy war in Ukraine right now with all of the funding. And that history, that the contemporary moment and what you're pointing to, I think is important to situate in a kind of deeper history, because there are ideological battles that are fought between opposing forces. But one element of ideological class struggle is the class struggle to define the very nature of the ideological terrain. And we have been subjected since about the 1970s, of course, these are ongoing things, but in the neoliberal era, to an attempt to categorically redefine the left as the compatible left. And again, this goes back even earlier than that, and there are traces of it that go back to World War II or even to World War I for that matter. But what that does, it displaces the entire ideological terrain, because then the left becomes divided between the communist left or the revolutionary socialist left that is considered unpalatable, beyond the pale, et cetera. And then the compatible left, which is compatible with capitalism and imperialism, becomes consolidated as the only left possible. That ideological struggle to define the very terrain of ideology has unfortunately, within certain sectors of global society, been won. And so in the belly of the beast, where I currently live and work in the United States, if you say that you're left, it means that you support imperialism and capitalism and usually various forms of white supremacy that might be, you know, disguised in other forms. And so that's been an ongoing political project. And in fact, the Frankfurt School that we mentioned a moment ago is directly linked to this, because in the very early years of the Frankfurt School, in the wake of World War I, it was originally founded as a kind of Marxist or Marxian think tank, bankrolled by a capitalist, in order to explore the reasons for the failure of the Russian Revolution to spread westward, and then became interested soon after that in the question of the rise of fascism. But as soon as Max Horkheimer took over the directorship of the Frankfurt School, or the Institute for Social Research in Frankfurt, Germany, he quickly pivoted away from political economy, away from the questions of worker struggles, away from a more class-based form of Marxist analysis, in favor of philosophic speculation, cultural concerns, and other such things that partially, I mean, they weren't the only ones, there were others doing this as well, laid the groundwork for this kind of culturalist turn. So you abandon class politics and you turn to an analysis, for instance, of anti-Semitism. And one of the extraordinary things that the Frankfurt School did is that they were funded by rather suspect sources that have connections to the Central Intelligence Agency to examine the supposed anti-Semitism of the workers' movement in the United States at a point in time at which it was very clear that the anti-Semitism, the principal anti-Semitism that was driving world politics, was the Judeo-Bolshevik conspiracy that had been concocted by Hitler and the Nazis, and that if you were looking for people who were anti-Semites, you could easily look at the Nazi Party, not at the workers and the communist struggle against anti-Semitism. And so in that regard, you have this displacement away from class analysis and in the favor of a culturalist analysis of anti-Semitism that lays a lot of the groundwork, actually, for what identity politics would become in the neoliberal age. And Todd Cronin's book, Red Aesthetics, actually has a chapter on this that I think is quite insightful, because he highlights this kind of pivot from class to culture as being an integral aspect of redefining the left as a culturalist left, not as a left rooted in class analysis. And I should add to that that this has also then developed a straw person representation of Marxism and the historical materialist tradition, because unfortunately then it has hammered home the mistaken idea that historical materialism has never been interested in race or gender or sexuality or nations and ethnicities, which could not be further from the truth. You know, of course, one of Lenin's principal platforms was the self-determination of nations. It was an anti-racist platform. Ho Chi Minh recognized that the strengths of Leninism were, amongst other things, the call for the slaves of the colonies to revolt, and that the global racialized working class in the imperial periphery had to be one of the fundamental sources for a revolutionary socialist transformation of society, in addition to, as Lenin said in his conversation with Clara Zetkin, women. He clearly stated the Russian Revolution would not have succeeded if it was not for the participation and the leadership role played by women. And so the history of actually existing socialism has been the history of not representing or giving certain forms of, you know, cultural symbolic gestures to those who have been historically quote unquote underprivileged, they've actually been super exploited and oppressed. It's been one of bringing them in to a struggle for material transformation in which you don't simply represent and recognize people who have been marginalized and excluded. You change the structures of exclusion so that you truly empower them and give them autonomy over their lives, politically, economically, and socially. And so the historical materialist tradition, all of this kind of cultural woke leftism has had to make a straw person out of the historical materialist tradition because they don't want people to know that the people who have been for, you know, well over a century, because this stretches back to Marx and Engels. Engels, of course, said that we should judge the emancipatory level of each society based on the relationship between men and women and how liberated women are within society. The woke culturalists don't want people to know that, because what they want to do is keep capitalism in place, keep imperialism in place, break a few glass ceilings for corporate feminists so that you can have a Hillary Clinton as the new war hawk or a Kamala Harris as the new war hawk and keep business as usual. Because culturalism and this kind of woke leftism allows the fundamentals of that system to be perpetuated, and the ones who put forth these types of ideologies don't want us to know that there are not only alternatives, but there have been very real struggles against these forms of purely symbolic and gestural politics in the name of transforming society in the best interest of the many and not simply the few.
You mentioned the CIA and also you kind of talked about you mentioned the compatible left and this culturalist wing of the so-called left that exists. And this brings up a question of the history of socialism and Marxism is also a history of splits and critiques, right? Different factions splitting and critiquing, whether we're looking at, early debates in the First International, or we're looking at the Sino-Soviet split, right? Or we're looking at the various factions within the early years of the, after the Russian Revolution, right? History of Trotskyism. Socialism, Marxism is a history of splits, critiques, and tensions within. But at the same time, you then have this process in the, especially during the Cold War, of a certain wing of the global left finding common cause, either consciously or not consciously, with the interests of the United States and Western powers, right? You saw some of this maybe during World War I when some leftists would side with the Allies or whatever, but really, especially your work goes into this idea about how there's this, the Frankfurt School or even and others their ideas will become not only compatible with, but actually be instrumentalized by the interests of the United States. And so I guess sometimes people crudely reduce this dynamic to be something of, certain ideas literally being under the marionette control of a power, and sometimes the dynamic is more complicated. So I guess in your studies, how do you analyze, see, and frame this dynamic between those elements of the 20th century Marxist left in the West who are, let's say, fellow travelers with, if not weapons of the interests of the United States and the Western imperial powers? How do you sort of look at that dynamic? How do you see its emergence? And do you see it as literally some of these people being self-conscious agents of the West, or more their ideas have developed in such a way to find common cause less intentionally with the interests of the United States and the West?
Yeah, it's a great question. I would just say, as a kind of preliminary to address the issue of the splits within the history of the, global socialist movement, is that one of the fundamental splits has been between those who have lined up on a social chauvinistic position supporting the orientation of their national bourgeoisies against the forms of actually existing socialism. And this goes back most famously, of course, to the Second International and the work of Karol Kautsky, who famously claimed that what is occurring in Russia, this was weeks after the Russian Revolution, what is occurring in Russia is in fact the last of the bourgeois and not the first of the socialist revolutions. And in response to this, Lenin penned his fiery text, The Proletarian Revolution and the Renegade Kautsky. And so that split between a Second International social chauvinistic Marxism that ultimately lines up on imperialism against actually existing socialism that's accused as being either bourgeois or adventurist or not truly socialist, et cetera, I think is one of the most fundamental splits in this history, because it plays itself out within the traditions that we're talking about. And what you have in Frankfurt School critical theory is they don't even pursue the Second International line. Like, they're not really invested in political organizing in that regard. So they're a further kind of right-wing iteration of that social chauvinistic pro-imperialist line. And then by the time you get to the woke leftism that we were talking about in the neoliberal age, it's even further to the right. And there's a kind of abandonment of even a vaguely Marxian modes of analysis. So I thought that I would just highlight that. But to speak more pointedly to the issue that you raise, I couldn't insist on the importance of what you pointed out, because sometimes I've had the problem of people engaging in the scholarship that I've done who think that the argument is something along the lines of there being a few shady figures in sunglasses with briefcases full of cash who visit professors and then ask them to write some slanderous things, and that that image itself, of course, is largely a product of Hollywood. And if you know anything about the history of Hollywood, the State Department, the Department of Defense, the Central Intelligence Agency, and the FBI and other agencies have been very, very deeply involved in the Hollywood production and in the production of the image of themselves qua agencies. So a lot of the misunderstanding of what it is that the Central Intelligence Agency or other agencies like this do is precisely linked to the kind of false image that's been proffered through Hollywood and the larger bourgeois cultural apparatus. And so I think it's much more coherent to understand, and this is the counter model that I've put forth, is that we have to look at how not just individuals function as free intellectuals who might then be offered certain deals, but instead begin the other way around from the point of view of the entire system of intellectual production, circulation, and consumption, or what Bertolt Brecht referred to as the bourgeois cultural apparatus. And that whole system includes a lot of factors. It's the universities and the think tanks and the publishing industry and the conference networks and the professional translators and the mass media, for that matter. All of that means that there is an extant system that mediates the relationship between individual intellectual production and its prominence within the larger social and political world. And so if we begin then from the point of view not of intellectual production, but from the point of view of the system that produces intellectuals, that then produce the products that are some of the products that we're talking about, what we see is a very clear pattern of relationships. And I might just touch on two examples that will make this quite concrete for your listeners. One is the Information Research Department that was set up in 1948 by the Foreign Office in Great Britain. The Information Research Department, or the IRD, was an international anti-communist propaganda network that was clandestine, but had far-reaching effects on this bourgeois cultural apparatus that I'm talking about. Its networks engulfed newspapers, magazines, news agencies, publishing houses, academic institutions, radio stations, and much more. They had between 400 and 600 professional propagandists who were working full-time for them. They were in constant contact with the BBC and regularly in conversation with London Press Service and with Reuters. According to Hugh Wilford, who's not a communist, who is not a historical materialist, but who has looked at the material record regarding the IRD, he claims the following, quote, by 1950, the IRD had succeeded in establishing permanent channels for the routine transmission of its by now considerable output of anti-communist propaganda all over the world. This included the incredible support for George Orwell, all of the translations of Animal Farm. In fact, there were also movie productions overseen by the CIA of that book, as well as the publication of some of the most famous and well-known books on the history of the Soviet Union. So Stanford fellow Robert Conquest's book, The Great Terror, Stalin's Purge in the 30s, drew extensively on IRD files. David Barzilay presented IRD's propaganda material in his historical writings as if it was his own. Oxford historian A.J.P. Taylor and Leonard Shapiro, who was a professor at the London School of Economics, both had IRD ties and were members of its, the latter was actually members of its inner circle. Brian Crozier was another, right? So what we have to see is that there's this systemic set of relations, and that then individuals work within that system. And I'll get on to the other example in just a moment, but what we have to understand is that the individuals working within that system are not simply freely producing intellectual work. Lenin, of course, famously said, and it kind of goes without saying, Hegel said as much, there's no such thing as individual freedom independent of society. You're only free insofar as you operate within a margin of maneuver within the extant society. And so the relationship between that system of cultural production and individual intellectual producers, I think, is best understood in terms of uplift, meaning that if you are an intellectual who wants to advance within the capitalist world, have a career, be invited to the lucrative conferences and junkets, be wined and dined, have your work translated into multiple languages, be interviewed on the radio. Everybody that I know understands how this system works. It's part of what, you know, someone like Bourdieu would call our habitus, or our kind of ingrained practical understanding of how a system works. You give to the system what it wants and you get uplift in return, meaning you get social ascension. And so one of the key factors in a lot of the individuals who have been working within the system is pure opportunism. They want to advance their individual careers. They know how the system works. They give to the system what it wants. And that often doesn't actually take a briefcase from the CIA. It simply takes a few intellectual junkets, a few, you know, airline tickets around the world. You can buy intellectuals really cheaply, unfortunately, in members of the professional managerial class. That said, you know, there are also very clear cases of intellectuals such as Sidney Hook or James Burnham, who were professors at New York University, who moonlighted for the CIA. They were straight up, particularly in the case of James Burnham, he was a CIA man. And there are many other instances of people who we know who are directly in the pay of the CIA. So we have to have a kind of variegated analysis that looks at all of the different levels of complicity, from the simple opportunism of giving to the system what it wants, to the kind of avid opportunism of some others, to those who were either partially in the know or should have been in the know, given the nature of these institutions. And so the other institution I'll just mention quickly, it's in some of my writings as well, is of course the Congress for Cultural Freedom, which was founded in the wake of the IRD and kind of took on some of the role of the IRD. It was established in the early 1950s. And according to, again, Hugh Wilford, who could not be suspected of pro-communist sympathies, but has given us a materialist analysis of the Congress for Cultural Freedom, it is the largest patron of arts and culture in the history of the world. It promoted on the international scene the kind of collaborationist academics and the opportunists that I was talking about. Raymond Aron is the most famous one in France, probably, but Hannah Arendt and many, many others who are, you know, Max Horkheimer, who we were talking about before, Theodore Adorno, published in the Congress for Cultural Freedom journals. They had offices in 35 countries. They mobilized an army of 280 employees. They published some 50 prestigious journals. They were involved in the book industry. They had also forum service, which provided free of charge all over the world, reports from intellectuals in 12 different languages that reached 600 newspapers and 5 million readers. Their budget in 1966 was the equivalent in contemporary dollars to $18 million, right? So this is an extraordinary, large propaganda outfit that is clandestine and that provides an entire system that affords the opportunity for certain individuals like Hannah Arendt, whose Origins of Totalitarianism was written with research help from the Foreign Office of Great Britain, the opportunity to ascend and become some of the most prominent intellectuals in the world, have their work translated all over the place. And it's one of the reasons why, if you read this work very closely, which I've done because I've spent decades and decades studying it, there's a remarkable conformity in the basic and fundamental theses that you find in all of this kind of generalized critical theoretical work. And that is that it is, quote unquote, anti-totalitarian, meaning that it's against actually existing socialism. And it actually often identifies, which is incredible, if you know anything about history, communism with fascism, in spite of the fact that some 27 million Soviets and some 20 million Chinese gave their lives defeating the Nazi war machine, and the overwhelming majority, 80% of the Third Reich's army was deployed on the Eastern Front. So the world historical defeat of Nazism was thanks primarily to the Soviets and the Chinese. And so that ideological idea is, you know, it takes an enormous amount of resources, power, and control to turn history on its head and to make things that are opposite, fascism and communism, into things that are the same. And so I think it's that broader understanding that we need of the bourgeois cultural apparatus and how it relates to individual opportunism, instead of simplistic models that are based on basically CIA-produced Hollywood versions of how the CIA works.
In the Cold War, the US government would use narratives, political narratives, historically the weapons of the left, in order to develop an anti-communist narrative, both for domestic purposes and for foreign policy. One of the things being, in particular, this idea that the real imperialist is the Soviet Union, right? This is the classic one, the red imperialism. Or a maybe lesser known instance, but was still used, was the idea that the real paradise for the working class is, you know, Cold War era, post-World War America, right? That every real worker is going to actually have an opportunity, you know, at the height of American unionism in the 1950s, right? Saying we've got this kind of strong working class and high property ownership amongst workers. And so, you know, unlike the Soviets, we're going to be this. But to me, this is like this pernicious dynamic where the US state is able to actually, you know, develop a narrative. And I'm particularly interested in this one about the Soviet Union being the real imperialist, selling this through the United Nations to recently decolonizing states in the third world struggle for clients between the socialist world and the capitalist world. And then I think more interestingly, finding you know, those who had left the communist world either before Sovietization or maybe after emigres in the United States to become sort of common, you know, to become allies in the development of this narrative domestically, or in the case of those who were living in Germany after the war, the famous cases of, you know, allying with various emigres against, to develop kind of anti-communist force. And so I guess I'm curious about the use by you talked about the state produced narratives, and sometimes I guess the thing that I'm always grappling with is when an idea is just an idea and when it actually has a real consequence in the world, you know? And I guess what I'm seeing, and the reason I'm saying this is because in the anti-Soviet, in the anti-communist, anti-Soviet politics of the Cold War, the idea that Soviet Union was the real colonialists, and look at these people who are leading these emigre circles in Europe, and look at these emigres who are in the United States. There's a real material social base that can back up our claim. You know, this is not just some ephemeral idea. We're sitting in a cafe. No. These are people who fought against Sovietization, and now look at them. Or these are people who sided with the Reich in World War II, and they've come now to the West, and they can tell us the evils of socialism. You know what I mean? And so I guess one of the problems that I always have is like how, when we're talking about these dynamics, really emphasizing the material rootedness of and utility of an idea versus it as some sort of like ephemeral critique. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, absolutely. There's a lot in what you brought up. I guess addressing maybe the first point first, what I would refer to as a process of political projection, right? So we know, at least from psychology, that at the level of individual projection, what some people do in like a lover spat or something like that is they take their own misbehaviors and, you know, screwed up personality, and they project it onto their, you know, enemy in the lover spat, and they say, no, you're the one who's being aggressive. You're the one who's being mean. You're the one who's doing... And that same basic psychological mechanism is so prevalent within the propaganda apparatus of the capitalist world, it just moves from an individual level to a social level. So all of the ills of capitalism that have been systematically pointed out by historical materialists, such as imperialism, are then projected onto countries that have no real history of imperialism. And we see this, of course, just to make sure that our conversation is grounded in contemporary politics. What greater example than the constant depiction in the US and European media of China as an imperialist country, when China does not have, it only has one military base outside of mainland China, which is to fight piracy in the Horn of Africa, not 800 to 1,000 like the United States, and has no history of military imperialist intervention like the United States. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, the last time that the Chinese deployed their military abroad was in the mid-1970s, right? So decades and decades ago. And that was during the Sino-Soviet split, actually. So it was in a very, very different context and for very different reasons. And so this tendency, which is very simplistic, but unfortunately works wonders at the level of propaganda, is to take the evils of the capitalist system and project them on the enemy. And then in order to try to shore that up, and this addresses the second point that you raised, which is equally important, is that they valorize, or they've tried to, because a lot of these CIA operations actually failed in many different ways. And there's an interesting book that came out recently on the use of dissidents, in particular Soviet dissidents in the West, and all of the failures along the way. But one of the things that they've tried to do is take individual experiences of often right-wing, philo-fascist people as a stand-in for the collective experience of people living under socialism, right? And so I think we probably all know the number of dissidents who are actually right-wing anti-communists who sided with the Nazis in the war against the Soviet Union, who are then deployed by these intelligence services as if they're reliable and upright and moral people who are going to explain the real functioning of the Soviet Union, when in fact they've always had a vested interest in a kind of extreme right-wing and fascist politics in various ways. And you know, another element to this that I think is really important is the mobilization of the intelligentsia in these types of projects. Because dissident politics isn't just a thing of the past. This goes on, you know, if you know, what's his name? There's a few of them. I'm going to escape the names. I'm going to forget right now. So I'll stick to the examples that I remember off the top of my head. But if you look at some of the most famous intellectuals in the Western world, they actually, many of them cut their teeth either as dissidents or as supporting dissidents. Slavoj Žižek, the kind of self-proclaimed, you know, Elvis of cultural theory, who presents himself as the most radical of radical Marxists, said himself in 2018, I was a dissident invested in the overthrow of the Yugoslav socialist government. And this is true, because he was writing for dissident magazines And he ended up running on a presidential ticket after the collapse of the socialist government there against the communists, right? So he's actually a long-standing dissident. And if we look at others like Michel Foucault, who had spent some time in Poland and then traveled to Poland and organized the reception of Polish dissidents in France as this kind of celebratory, anti-totalitarian, pro-freedom, pro-Western political propaganda. You have the same thing with Jacques Derrida. Few people know this, but there's a famous incident where Jacques Derrida was arrested by the Czech authorities in, I believe it was the late 1960s. And they said that they had discovered some, I believe, marijuana or hash on him. There was an altercation. It went all the way to the top of the French presidency. And then the French president put pressure on Czechoslovakia to release Derrida back to the West. Why was Derrida there in the first place? Well, he was there because he was one of the founders of the Jan Hus Foundation, which is a foundation that receives funding from the foundation network of the capitalist world, including the Margaret Thatcher Foundation and the National Endowment for Democracy, which is a well-known cutout for the Central Intelligence Agency. And he was doing anti-totalitarian propaganda within Czechoslovakia. That was one of the reasons that there was concern about what he was doing. This is moreover an intellectual who, in spite of all of his obfuscation, and I did my master's thesis under the direction of Derrida, studied his work very closely. So what I'm not saying as a kind of off-the-cuff remark, Derrida is on record as saying that anyone who studies historical materialism and Marxism should almost be obliged to engage with intellectual endeavors of a Heideggerian sort. And Heidegger is an unrepentant Nazi, right? And so Derrida also played a central role in rehabilitating Heidegger as the most important or one of the single most important intellectuals of the 20th century, and worked moreover very closely and owes a lot of his American reputation to Paul de Man. Paul de Man was a Nazi collaborator in Belgium and then lied about his entire past and reinvented himself so that he could eventually get a job at Yale, promote deconstruction, and invite his Heidegger-loving French ally to Yale and promote the work of deconstruction as this kind of project within the rising wave of French theory in the West. All of that to just kind of flesh out this larger issue of how the projection of imperialism onto the Soviet Union or actually existing socialism is actually then deeply related to the cultural imperialism of the Western world that is trying to shore up this image of moral superiority and praise of freedom and defense of human rights and other such things in order to really run heinous propaganda campaigns against those who are struggling in fits and starts with many difficulties, with imperialist incursions, with internal splits and difficulties as well, but to build a world that is distinct from the incredible exploitation, degradation, and oppression that you find within the capitalist world.
So it's a lot of the French intellectuals that sort of paved the way for the German school and then the French philosophers. And why do you think that is? Actually, it's something I've thought about. Why has it been so embraced? Is it because of sort of May 68 sort of giving this rise to so many opportunists and using this moment? Why is that?
There's surely a number of complex historical reasons, but one of the clearest is that, of course, in the case of the United States, they were very reticent to enter World War II because they wanted the Soviet Union to be bled to death. Truman said as much. We should just wait and see how many can die on each side, the Nazis and the communists, and then enter the war late in order to basically then shore up and become the new imperial hegemon, at least to a certain extent, which is what they did in the wake of World War II. But then what they did immediately is they were very invested in a project of cultural imperialism that was about, and maybe just a little bit more context, because then of course the Red Army defeated the Nazis and they marched west. And one of the reasons that the US entered the war is because they saw the writing on the wall and they were like, oh, if we just let this happen, then all of Europe is going to go communist. So we have to get in the war and we have to shore up Western Europe as a beachhead against the communists. And so that's what they did. But then the cultural imperialist front was really Western Europe. France and Italy were the central sites of investment for the following reason, and that is given the fact that the right wing and the liberals had been massively discredited due to the rise of fascism, because the right wing were fascist and the liberals aided and abetted the rise of fascism. In the wake of World War II, the communist parties there were extremely powerful, and there was a general cultural ethos that identified communism as the thing that fights fascism and the people who say, you know, the people who basically saved Europe from annihilation or from the kind of continuing colonial pursuits of the Nazi Reich in particular. Of course, there were other forces, Italy and Japan, that were also fascist. And so France and Italy became central beachheads. In the case of Germany, of course, it was split. And very quickly, the US overtook and controlled the Christian Democratic Party, as well as the intelligence services in Western Germany. And they redeployed an incredible number of Nazis in order to do that. And so given the prominence of France and Italy in this struggle against communism, there was a real focus on the intelligentsia within those countries. In the case of West Germany, I think there was already quite a bit of kind of, there was less of, given the fact that the Nazi Reich was there, and the communists were the first people who were sent to the gas chambers, there was much less of a kind of communist element. But of course, Germany was centrally important for a few reasons. One is that between the First World War and the end of the Second World War, the US and Germany basically handed the baton back and forth to try to destroy Bolshevism in the East. And so they were longstanding imperial partners in that agenda. And the ruling class, we have to see, even though there were wars between those countries, we have to see that the ruling classes understand how wars work, right? They're on the side of the ruling class, meaning they're the ones who benefit from these wars. And foreign direct investment in Germany actually spiked in the interwar period. And the capitalist ruling class in the United States also helped fund the rise of Hitler, as Jock Powells and Suzanne Poole and many others have pointed out in detail. Quite extensively. And so I think it really needs to be understood that it's that Western European front, both kind of culturally, politically, and socially, that was integral to pushing back what was understood on the part of the Western capitalists as the barbarians at the gates, because here these Bolsheviks are, you know, proposing a different way of organizing society where, you know, instead of being slaves to the capitalist system and slaves to imperialism, they could self-determine. And that was horrific. And so the shoring up of Western Marxism and Western kind of culturalism and cultural politics in general was overall, I think, a war on, you know, the alternative and making sure that as much as possible, at least, because there were many, many failures along the way, the Western intelligentsia turned away from the Marxism, which was kind of the lingua franca of the Western European intelligentsia in the definitely in the 1930s, but then also in the 1940s and 1950s, right? And so actually French theory, as we see it rise, and German style critical theory, we can't forget that like Jean-Paul Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir were both Marxists, right? They weren't members of the Communist Party. They had a complicated relationship to some aspects of the Communist Party in France, but they were fellow travelers. They were anti-imperialists. They took some positions that I disagree with, but they were invested in global class struggle and were far, far, far to the left of Foucault and Derrida and Adorno and Horkheimer and Marcuse and all of these people. And so Marcuse, of course, has his own trajectory, and we could talk about that because he came a kind of figure in New Left politics, but was definitely opposed to the Soviet Union and to China, and was instead in favor of a kind of student-based politics or rebellious politics and things like that. So sorry, that might have been a little bit too long, but just trying to sketch out the broader scope of some of these struggles.
No, thank you for that. Actually, I would want even more information, but I could see that some people might get bogged down by too many details, especially if they don't have any reference to any of the French philosophers and French so-called left. So, this whole thing really begins, and why you're so interesting for us to even interview, is really this complete abandonment of Soviet Union, this so-called compatible left, which I really like the terminology. And this idea, you know, of totalitarianism has become so common to use the terminology. We actually started this podcast, and the first thing we said was like, we are not going to use these terms or invite anyone on who believes this or like wants to talk about totalitarianism. So can you discuss more? Because it feels like people think that that's so normal to discuss Soviet Union's totalitarian terms, or even sometimes like China now, but that could be even up for more. What is the nature of China? I don't want to get into that, but like sort of like Soviet Union, why it's equated. And it's, I find it so interesting because it's like, it's this bastardization of Marx, which he says, like, it's a social system. You know, he's like, it's capitalism. Everything is sort of affected by capitalism. And it's like Arendtian, like more hyped up version of totalitarianism, is like trying to use these Marxist concepts to then try to denounce Marxism in this really ugly kind of way, very vulgar. And so I would like to maybe like talk about that. And that also leads to how communism has been criminalized in the West, and this war that has been unleashed for many, many years, decades, sort of first conditioning the fertile ground to then how it could be denounced later on by the Polish and the Lithuanians and so on after the collapse of the Soviet Union. The West also giving them these ready-made philosophers and so on they could draw on from, and even the Holocaust being as a example of them, how the Holocaust memorials happen, them copying it and sort of copy-pasting it and applying it to the victims of communism. Yes, maybe you can address this totalitarianism and how ultimately communism has been equated to Nazism. And in some ways that is still, the war is raging, but they have won this battle.
Yeah, it's a really important point. The term and the concept of totalitarianism, I would say one thing that might be a little bit different than what you touched on, and it's actually not research that I've done myself, but the great Domenico Lasordo has pointed out, and given the rigor and depth of his analyses and the fact that he's someone I'm constantly learning from myself, I take it that he's probably right on this front, is that the term and concept actually has a deeper history. And that was the communist critique of capitalism as being a totalitarian society that tries to control every single aspect of social and political life and has been invested in this kind of colonial dynamic of, you know, setting up concentration camps in the global periphery and using them to totally control the populations there. And he sees this as well as playing itself out in the Nazi Third Reich, because it was a goal, one of the goals was the total annihilation of the race that was targeted for elimination, and that was the Judeo-Bolsheviks. And I think it's important to see that there's a confluence between these two groups, at least in the minds of some of the Nazi leaders. So that is one use of totalitarianism that I think is very much worth exploring and investigating. But of course, everything that you say regarding the more contemporary uses of totalitarianism is absolutely spot on. And one of the things, and this relates more to some of the research that I've done myself, is that the term was really weaponized in the post-war era. And there are two figures to point to in this regard, one of whom you already highlighted is Hannah Arendt. And as I mentioned in passing, The Origins of Totalitarianism was written with support and research help from the British Foreign Office. So there are the footprints, or the handprints, or the fingerprints, if you will, of the British intelligence on that book itself, which should raise some very serious questions about the way the concepts used, the way the research was done, and other such things. But of course, the other major figure was Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was Jimmy Carter's national security advisor from 1977 to 1981, who in the mid-1950s also co-authored a book on totalitarianism. And very much like Arendt and many of the other ideological uses of the term totalitarianism, there was an attempt to do the impossible. And that was, as quickly as possible, after World War II to redefine the very nature of global class struggle in ways that confused the masses. As we know in history, of course, after the Russian Revolution of 1917, 14 capitalist countries invaded the Soviet Union from 1918 to 1920 to, in the words of Winston Churchill, strangle the red babe in its crib. And that did not succeed. And therefore, we have to understand the Nazi rise to power in, amongst other things, as it being, amongst other things, a continuation of the struggle to kill Soviet communism that had failed as of 1920. And the reason that I point that out is because the logic of totalitarianism and the logic of that is dominant in the Cold War is really just getting back to the old war. And the old war was the war between capitalism and communism. And so World War II also functions as it's a kind of element that has made many people, particularly within the capitalist West, not understand the true nature of global class struggle because of the fact that the Soviet Union ended up being allied for a number of serious, of important kind of contradictions with Great Britain and the United States. But the United States wanted to get to back to the old war, and the old war was the war on communism. But everyone had recognized that the communists had defeated the fascists and that the real enemies were the Nazis because of the genocidal elimination of at least 6 million people and the plans, according to Michael Rome, who pointed out that actually the gas chambers in Europe were only it was priming the pump and the warm-up routine for what they were planning in the Soviet Union, which was planning to eliminate 60 million people. And they wanted to perfect their tools of death in order to really take care of, once and for all, the threat of Bolshevism or the threat of communism. And so in that regard, totalitarianism tries to do the impossible and get us back to the old war, which is the war against communism. And that is by taking what people clearly identified as an evil, Nazism and fascism, and equating it through this kind of horseshoe theory where the two extremes somehow meet with communism. To do that, they basically had to rewrite history. And that's one of the reasons that so many revisionist historians have been employed by the bourgeois cultural apparatus we were talking about, promoted, like Hannah Arendt would be an example of this, in order to transform history into the idea that there is the realm of freedom and the freedom-loving, human rights-loving West, and then these cruel people who are genocidal, and they can either be Nazis or communists, but basically they amount to the same thing. And of course, this has had really significant impact on the contemporary world. And as you probably know, now the European Union has a resolution in which they take the line of totalitarianism. They equate fascism and communism as the two sources of World War II and basically encourage European Union states to defend this line and to, they celebrate those states that have outlawed communist symbols, basically rewritten history in various ways.